We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, let's dive into today's menu, starting with Costco.
Yeah, Costco added another $2.8 million in cash to the Tobacco Initiative 1183, the liquor privatization.
So they have a lot of liquid assets.
Indeed. Their total cash contributions now to I-1183, the Liquor Privatization Initiative, total $9.6 million, and their in-kind contributions are $1.4 million, bringing their total contributions to an initiative, to this particular initiative, to $11 million. Now, the campaign itself has raised $11.2 million, so that tells you that it's nearly all of it come from Costco. So it truly is the Costco initiative. Now, the anti-liquor privatization groups fighting Initiative 1183, they've raised about $7.4 million, mainly from liquor and wine distributors. Costco, with this current donation, has become the second largest contributor to a state initiative campaign in Washington state history. The largest was last year when the American Beverage Association gave $16.7 million to support Initiative 1107 to repeal the tax on candy, gum, soda, and bottled water.
And that worked.
And yes, it absolutely did. So Costco is looking at this going, well, it takes at least $10 million to buy a law in the state
we'll
of Washington.
Back.
Yeah. And I just want to point out,
not
too,
just any law, but a law that specifically not only enables them to sell liquor, but prevents most of their competitors from doing so.
Yeah. And I want to point out, too, that Costco was formerly the number two. They surpassed themselves with these donations. They were the number two last year when they gave to Initiative I-1100, the other liquor privatization initiative that didn't pass. That year, they gave almost $5 million. So here they've more than doubled it. And these huge campaign donations are really that's really what they're doing. They're trying to feel out how much it costs to buy a law in the state of Washington. And from what we can tell, it takes at least $10 million.
And I've been kind of steering clear of the election and election commentary just because of my day job this year. But one of the things that has definitely been noticed on the campaign trail, and this is not something that's been remarked on very much in local media coverage, is that individual donations to political campaigns are not very good this year, but corporate donations are way up.
Yes.
And that's true for initiatives, but it's also true for elected candidates.
Yeah, and you know
which is one reason why incumbents have such a huge advantage, because that's where most corporate money goes.
Exactly, to support the folks that have done well for them. The Public Disclosure Commission has formally only reported a couple of instances up until last year, a couple of instances where anyone gave more than $1 million to an initiative campaign. And so these last 2 years with these kind of commercial initiatives that allow businesses to make or ensure their profits, these are the ones that are really responsible for these huge boosts in campaign financing. Now, Costco just squeaked in with this latest donation. They just squeaked in under the deadline, because on the 18th of this month, no one will be able to give more than $5,000. After the 18th of the month, no one will be able to give more than $5,000 to any one campaign in that last few weeks push before the vote is taken in early November.
Yeah, it wasn't an accident either. They very deliberately timed it.
Yes.
to be a last minute donation like that. And you can expect, if you're watching television, to see a ton of Costco sponsored ads for this initiative over the next 3 weeks. Probably some with unsupportable.
You're already seeing them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You're going to even see even more. Probably some of them on unsupportable claims, because one of the things you can do with that kind of money is put out the kind of claims where by the time they're debunked, it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Occupy Seattle. The Occupy movement.
Did I mention, by the way, that we're gonna start an Occupy Studio A movement here? And we brought our tents.
All right. Well, I will alert the authorities, and the pepper spray should be released momentarily.
We brought our gas masks too.
Yeah, we did.
You're gonna need them.
And our Guy Fawkes masks. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, Occupy Seattle and the Occupy movement in general, taking several dramatic steps forward this week. We'll start local and expand outward, but there's been quite a few arrests and a couple of different kerfuffles with Seattle's finest this week over sort of a schizophrenic approach by the city as to whether the Occupy movement on Westlake Park can erect any kind of structures or not. On Thursday night, they tried to erect a tent. They already have one for cooking and
first aid
and that sort of thing. They tried to erect another one that is sort of a central gathering area that was fairly quickly torn down by police with a dozen or so arrests. And yet the bigger confrontations that people keep fearing simply don't happen. And nationally, they haven't been happening that much. You know, in New York, they were threatening to shut it down on Friday morning, and apparently a barrage of calls on Thursday night convinced the city and the owners of the park where people are in Manhattan to stand down. There have been problems in Denver and Boston, but by and large, for the literally scores of different Occupy movements around the country, pretty much local governments have been letting them stay put. Now, whether here in Seattle that's going to continue to be the case, particularly when we get into the holiday and carousel season, of course, that's 6 weeks away. But we have a pretty good idea where the city's priorities are when those two might come into conflict.
Yeah, what really bothers me is this back and forth by Mayor McGinn, you know, on Monday coming to visit the Occupy Seattle group at Westlake and kind of making his official appearance, and then issuing a permit saying, well, we'll allow you to have a tent at Westlake under certain conditions, but the conditions weren't super specific. And then later saying, well, changing the terms of the permit and then revoking the permit and tearing, you know, and the police coming in and arresting people, you know, from time to time who try to set up not necessarily tents, but just awnings or a teepee.
Something to protect people from the elements.
To keep the rain off. Yeah. And then on Tuesday, you know, the mayor said, well, I prefer you folks go camp out at City Hall.
Go away.
Well, no, he offered City Hall, but he said, I want you to give me a proposal for what you need to relocate to City Hall. And you got to give it to me by Tuesday at 8 p.m. or I'm going to evict you from Westlake. And then, you know, so they sit down and the protesters draft a proposal and send it to...
Which is not an easy thing, given that everything has to be done
by consensus
with hundreds of people.
Yeah, and they send him a proposal, and then the media gets a hold of it, and starts blowing it all out of proportion, saying, well, oh, you know, they want the city to provide them tents, and they want access to restrooms 24 hours a day, and the meeting rooms at City Hall, and they want parking spaces too, making them sound like they're these selfish teenagers who want their or millionaires who must have their own parking spaces. Well, come on, you know what they asked for was they asked for a parking space so that they could unload food
basically
a load zone, which they have, which they can get at Westlake fairly easily, but is much more difficult to get at City Hall. You know, and access to restrooms is not unreasonable when you have people there 24/7, and being able to erect tents.
And,
well, that's
and
the
not
point
only
of
is
the
it,
demonstration.
And not only is it not unreasonable, but that's been done before when they've had emergency homeless encampments there too.
Yeah, and you know, and then they asked the mayor, okay, give us a written promise that you're not going to evict us once we get to City Hall and we're kind of out of the sight of the public. And then, of course, that was called, oh, they want the mayor to give them a written, you know, a written passport to stay there forever, blah, blah, blah. You know, the media just blew it all out of proportion when it was not a list of demands. It was a proposal that they were required to give to the mayor. So I'm kind of disgusted with the media coverage of all this as well.
Yeah. And hey, you don't want people to stay there forever? Generate some jobs.
Yeah.
That's easy enough.
Or address their concerns.
Yeah. You know? That would work too.
And it's very clear to me that the mayor is showing this kind of schizophrenic attitude, because he does, I think, to a certain on a certain level support what the protesters are doing and saying, but he's getting a lot of pressure from the Downtown Business Association because these people are not going away.
Particularly the places in the retail core who have these visions of the you know the retail season around Christmas, which you know realistically now starts the 1st of November. You know, people being put off by these scraggly protesters, you know, because we can't have shoppers mingling with the 99%.
Yeah, that's right. Even though many of the shoppers are the 99%. But I think really that things tend to go better for the protesters on the whole if there are more people there. And they're more sort of not just the people who are there 24/7, but people coming during the day to support them. I think that's the key here, and I think folks listening to the show this morning should be keeping that in mind and thinking about going down there to visit.
Yeah, and actually today there's a couple things going on. We'll mention this at the events at the end of the half hour too. There's a rally at noon, 3 o'clock. There's a march to Chase Bank, which is one of the targets of the protest, of course. And then at 5 o'clock there'll be raising of the Night of 500 Tents, which is an event that they'll be doing all night tonight. They want to test the city in terms of its commitment to not allowing tents. Mm-hmm. And we'll see there. The concern that I have with a lot of this back and forth and cat and mouse with the city and the police department is that it really and we've seen this in other cities and we've seen it in the past with demonstrations. Certainly this became the case with the WTO and some of the summit hopping that happened in the couple of years after that, where the cat and mouse with the police and with the city and the right to protest and in this case the right to camp becomes what people get focused on rather than the large message. And the large message, the political gridlock, the fact that decisions are being made that are not in the interest of the vast majority of people in this country and around the world, that needs to continue to be the primary focus and the primary message. And, you know, if you can't camp one place, you camp some other place. It's not about a particular piece of real estate as anything more than a symbolic act. But you really do not need to get drawn into this whole sort of back and forth with we have a right to do this or we have a or the police are being unfair about that, because that's not the message that the public by and large needs to hear. What the public needs to hear is that they are being represented by the people who are out there on the square.
All right, and you mentioned the other cities nationally that are doing
this. Not just nationally, but around Washington State also. There was an Occupy Red Square event on UW campus on Wednesday, which was encouraging to see. Uh-huh. Occupy Olympia has been going strong. There's an event today up in the San Juan Islands. I believe there's one in Bellingham as well. Around the world today, it's a global day today. The last count that I saw was well over 1,000 different cities around the world were having events, including very large ones in London at the London Stock Exchange, in Madrid, Frankfurt, Sydney, Tokyo, Melbourne, Seoul, Rome, all sorts of different places. So it's very much gone global. There's more than 60 cities in Spain alone, which of course is largely where the Occupy Wall Street drew its inspiration from in the first place, was the Arab Spring and the demonstrations in Spain this past May and June. So it's rebounding around the world, and it's remarkable. If you go to the list of the cities around the world is at map.15october.net. And it's remarkable if you look at these different calls, at least the ones that are in English or Spanish, which are the two languages that I can kind of understand. It's remarkable how in all of these different cities, the language is almost exactly the same about the corruption and non-responsiveness of local government, about ordinary people not being able to get jobs, not being represented in supposedly democratic countries. This is a global movement at this point, and it is a global movement that is only going to get stronger, and it's going to get stronger here in Seattle, but it's going to get stronger in a lot of different places. It's going to be very interesting in the coming election year in 2012, because I think candidates and elected officials are going to be forced to respond to this, and whether they're going to be respond to it by being dismissive or by trying to clamp down on it or by ridiculing it or by actually trying to make gestures gestures in the direction of addressing concerns. It's going to be very interesting to see.
All right. Anything else on that? Or
let's move on.
All right. The auto workers are in negotiations this week.
Yeah, it's been contract negotiation season for the United Auto Workers and the three big U.S. car companies, Ford, GM, and Chrysler. And there's been some discussion on Facebook in particular, but in other arenas too, that Ford workers are voting negatively on the current contract. And so I would expect probably to see strikes coming up. The two big things at issue is the fact that Ford has paid out big bonuses for Ford executives in the past year, but the contract that they're offering the workers doesn't involve much in the way of pay increases for the guys on the shop floor. And that's something the workers are saying, hey, you know, we sacrificed for the company over the last 2 to 3 years so that you could survive the economic downturn. Now that things are going good, you need to compensate us for that, not just upper management.
And particularly in the case where taxpayer funds were used with GM and Chrysler, I mean, taxpayer funds are being used to enrich the upper
advantage of them as well.
Yeah, the taxpayer funds are going to enrich upper management, but not the workers.
Yeah. And the other thing that they're protesting is the two-tier wage system. Now, the auto workers said, okay, you know, in 2008, they said, okay, well, you know, you guys are in trouble and we don't want the companies to go under. We'll allow you to hire new workers at a lower wage than you're paying your experienced workers. So they allowed the companies to institute a two-tier wage system where they pay newer workers a lower wage. And with the idea that the companies would let those new hires catch up to the experienced workers in their wage system, and that they would eventually limit or stop altogether hiring new workers at the lower wage, so that there would be limits on the use of the lower wage tier, and that's not in the contracts that they're looking at right now. The contracts do have a limit, but not nearly what the United Auto Workers had demanded. And they're saying, look, now that the companies are back on their feet, they need to bring wages up so that there's not this two-tier wage system anymore. We don't want that to be a permanent fixture. So really what it's coming down to is, the United Auto Workers, they kind of set the tone for a lot of what happens in labor in this country. So it's really becoming, in their minds, a make-or-break time for unions in the U.S. if the workers don't hold the line on this two-tier wage system and demand a little bit better pay increases with these contracts, then it could be just one more step back for the U.S. labor movement.
From there on to other economic news this week.
Yeah, there was an interesting article in the Sunday New York Times this week, and the title of the article was called The Depression, If Only Things Were That Good. And this article actually got quite a bit of discussion, I know, particularly among the folks who pay attention to economic stuff in this country. It was written by the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, David Lanart, and he basically was looking at what's wrong with the current economy and comparing it to the 1930s. He talked about cyclical trends, basically short-term problems, versus secular trends or long-term global changes in the structure of the economy as a whole. And his point was that he argued that in the 1930s there was a deep cyclical slump, but at the same time there were positive secular trends or technological innovations that were going on that were going to eventually pull us out of the Great Depression. But he doesn't see those kind of secular trends right now. Of course, what he didn't talk about is what I think is the real, what really pulled us out of the Great Depression. He kind of mentions in passing, well, you know, then World War II came along and really helped us, you know, get completely out of the Great Depression. Well, I would argue that it was World War II.
When I was smiling a minute ago and you were probably wondering what it was. I was wondering whether fascism was one of those secular, encouraging secular
trends. He was talking about things like improvements in transportation and technology and stuff. But I more agree with the argument that it was the heavy militarism, the heavy spending on the Cold War that really boosted the economy in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And that you can argue, of course, that that's wasted spending. But by the 1960s, by the 50s and the 1960s, we'd found a way to use the money spent on U.S. military toys, essentially, in Korea and Vietnam. But of course, by the 1970s, the economy was in trouble again. But what I found most interesting about his article was his analysis of our current decade. He really does talk a little bit about how weak job growth from 2001 to 2007 didn't really keep pace with the population trend of the 2000s. That it really wasn't a prosperous decade, and that incomes barely kept pace with inflation. In addition, he pointed out that two things happened during the decade of the 2000s, that higher education became very, very expensive, and that's been a trend over the last 20 to 30 years, and that it's much harder for folks in the U.S. to get a four-year degree, and that at the same time, during this current downturn, people with a four-year degree have a relatively low unemployment rate compared to people who only have a high school education or less. The other trend he also pointed to was the misallocation of resources. And he talked about three industries in particular, leaving out what I would argue to be the biggest industry that's a misallocation of resources. He talked about healthcare, which is a zero-sum game. You can't keep spending more and more and more and more money on healthcare and expect to get anything productive out of it. Housing, which has been a bubble, same thing. You can't keep spending more and more money on houses and expect that to be productive. And finance, essentially, people making money off of the tiny price changes in stocks, bonds, and commodities and derivatives and other ephemera. That's not productive use of resources. He doesn't mention the fourth non-productive resources, which is the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which I think is a great waste of resources. So I found his article very interesting in some ways, spot on in his analysis, almost spot on in his analysis of what our current problem is, but also very reflective of the big blind spot in American economic history, which is our military spending.
All right. Anything else on that?
No. And I wanted to just briefly mention the Volcker Rule, that the FDIC, the SEC, the Federal Reserve, and the Comptroller of the Currency released proposed rules for the Volcker Rule, which is the rule that is meant to prohibit banks and other financial companies from doing proprietary trading, that is, doing trading for their own benefit rather than their clients' benefit. That's a great rule to have on the books. It was a big part of the Dodd-Frank legislation, but this proposed rule has some loopholes in it that are big enough to drive a semi through. One of them is that it lets banks hedge their positions that their customers take, and that's a fuzzy line. When banks can buy and sell, can do trading in order to hedge their customers' bets, well, you know, it's hard to argue whether that's trading for their customers or trading for their own benefit. And banks and other companies can still make markets, and they can still do underwriting ostensibly for the benefit of their clients. But again, that's a fuzzy line between what benefits their clients and what benefits the company in general. But even more, it allows banks to hedge against anticipated risks. Not current risks, but anything that they may foresee. And that makes it even more fuzzy and more vague. So the Volcker Rule, there's finally a proposal out there for it. People can make comments on it through January 13th when they will vote and issue the final rules on it. But it's not looking like it's going to be a strong one.
All right, moving on. free trade agreements made this week.
Yeah, briefly, three different free trade deals passed the Senate this week with South Korea, with Colombia, and with Panama. Colombia probably being the most controversial of those because of the atrocious human rights record of the Colombian government. But all three passed the Senate with large bipartisan majorities, really probably the only significant legislation that will be passed by Congress this year. And it really tells you what the economic priorities of both the Democrats and the Republicans are, that they can come together on this when they can come together on virtually nothing else. And if you look at that, loopholes in the Volcker Rule, the long-term economic structure, the problems in auto negotiations, all of those are excellent reasons why you ought to be out in Westlake today.
Yes.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Iran.
Yeah, well, again, this was something Counterspin covered, so we won't spend a whole lot of time on it, but the alleged plot that was, announced today involving the assassination of the Saudi ambassador to the United States and several other things, had a really seriously misleading, media coverage. The U.S. government was, very careful to insinuate but not come right out and say that this was something that the, Iranian government was involved in, the Revolutionary Guard and the Quds. But it really does not make a lot of sense. And if you actually sit down and look at the indictment, there really is no clear link to the Iranian government involved in any of this. And it's a very, it's a very atypical kind of plot for the Quds force to be involved in. And secondly, it also very, very sloppy for them as an operating procedure. They're usually a lot better than that, to be quite honest. And thirdly, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, why would they kick the hornet's nest in by trying to do something on United States soil when they can target their enemies in Saudi Arabia in many, many other different ways? So again, as is almost always the case with an alleged terrorist plot announced on American soil by U.S. media, treat initial media reports with many, many heaping generous grains of salt.
All right. And Japan, Tokyo?
Yeah. New York Times story today that Citizens Monitoring has found 22 hot spots around the metropolitan area of Tokyo out of 132 tested for levels of cesium in the soil.
This is Citizens Monitoring, this,
yes,
not
I'll
government.
I'll
right?
get to that. This is this is levels of cesium in the soil equivalent to areas near Chernobyl being found by ordinary citizens with the dosimeters. After the government basically didn't bother to do the monitoring for them. Now, this is the largest metropolitan area in the world, with some 35 million people living in and around it. And, you know, it really raises a very serious question about the health and welfare. Now, obviously, the radioactive hotspots are not uniformly distributed throughout that area, but any number of people might be at very serious risk because of this. And has been pretty consistently the case ever since last March. The Japanese government has been understating the risk, minimizing the risk, and doing nothing to find out what the problem is.
All right. And Africa, Central Africa.
Yeah. President Obama sending 100 armed military advisors this week to Central Africa, that being the area around Uganda, Congo, Central African Republic, and South Sudan, to fight the Lord's Resistance Army, which, as people may be aware, has been a very nasty guerrilla movement in the area for some 20, 25 years that has been recruiting child soldiers, massacring villagers, etc. Now, granted that they're a bad group, and human rights groups have generally applauded this move. But why now, after 20 years, or after 3 years of the Obama administration? Well, you know, you can never be fighting too many wars in an election year. I think that's kind of what it comes down to.
All right. And events.
Well, as we mentioned, today is a big day for Occupy Seattle. There will be a rally at noon. At 3 o'clock, a march over to Chase Bank. And at 5 o'clock, the raising of a night of 500 tents. And then we'll find out this evening how many of those tents will stand. So at any point today, the more warm bodies they have down at Westlake Park, the better. So scurry on down there and check it out. Just talk to some folks and participate in the movement. Be part of the 99%.
All right.
And then other events this week. Tuesday, October 18th, Seymour Hersh will be in the area. He'll be down at UW-Tacoma at Philip Hall talking at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are required for that, but they are free tickets. Wednesday, October 19th at Westlake Park, as part of World Food Day, Jeffrey Smith will be speaking in a rally against genetically modified organisms. And then there will be a talk at 6:30 that evening at University Christian Church. And then next week, with the mailing of the ballots for the general election November 8th, we will be having a print edition of Eat the State. So look at that free of charge wherever you find free periodicals.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Well, as I mentioned, we've got the free issue coming out this coming week where you can find it around town. It's also available online, as will be our endorsements and all that other kind of good news at www.eatthestate.org.